inviting me, and I was already very pleased about the discussion that we had that led up to now. And I'd like to pick up on a couple of things that people here in the room have already mentioned, namely going into the world beyond letters, developing a new vocabulary to capture these developments. And also something I didn't get your name. What's your name?
Reinhard.
Reinhard mentioned that sometimes we are working in one corner, in one obscure corner of the world, and cannot really locate a person or identify a person in that, but it may be very well known in another obscure corner of the world. So my question when I thought about how this particular presentation fits into this workshop was, are we talking here, since I'm talking about the Islamic world, are we talking here about parallel universes? And so basically we have similar questions, we have similar difficulties, let's look at how other people have dealt with this and what kind of solutions have they found, or are we talking about connected universes? And a couple of years ago, I think that's when I attended the first of these wonderful workshops and conferences that Cultures of Knowledge has organized, it occurred to me that Comenius is somebody who is really, really important for the Islamic world, because he commissioned one of the first translations of the Quran into Ottoman Turkish, of the Bible into Ottoman Turkish, in order to convert Muslims to Christianity. All of this is connected to chiliastic expectations, to bringing about the end of the world and things like that. For us, he's kind of, you know, the periphery. For Cultures of Knowledge, perhaps a place where all of this happened, Constantinople, Istanbul, is a periphery. So keep in mind, perhaps while you are all listening to this, whether we can, in terms of these shared problems, think about two different, distinct universes, or possibly something that is connected. Just like Comenius had an interest in Ottoman for his own purposes, in the same way the manuscripts that impact is dealing with are now sitting in libraries in Europe. They sit in Leiden, they sit in Oxford, they sit in Paris, they sit in St. Petersburg, they sit in Vienna, and they didn't drop down there now in the 21st century. They came precisely during the 16th, 17th centuries into those libraries. There was a strong interest and strong connection. Now, why people matter. You see here credit to Cultures of Knowledge. I said Impact is a little sister of Cultures of Knowledge, in the sense that Cultures of Knowledge has very kindly shared the code and backend with Impact, because there were so many parallel issues that we were dealing with. Now, Impact is after manuscripts of works, not letters. So there were certain areas that we had to develop. One was manifestations of individual works, many, many copies that are around, and one was people. So why people matter? I'll give you a very, very quick background about what this is all about. Islamic history is conceived normally, you know, in scholarship until today, has very recently only started to change. That there's a golden age in terms of the politics that we're talking about. 600 to 900 is the formative period of Islam, Arabs rule, and then we have non-Arabs coming, and that's already a decline. Iranians, Turks, Mongols, in terms of law, the legal main legal schools were formed by the mid-10th century. So people, however, do define themselves, Sunnis do define themselves by their legal schools. So we have something that's really called Madhhab legal school, that's like being a Protestant or being a Catholic. That's how you marry, that's how you inherit, that's how you organize your life. theology, very similarly, mid-10th century, we have the main schools, Asharism, Maturidism, have been formed. In terms of philosophy, it goes slightly later. We have two translation movements, one from Greek into Arabic in Baghdad, and then from Arabic into Latin, mostly in Spain. That's also done by the 12th century, and with changes in European interests, that is also ends then. And then anything after 1258 basically is decline. That's really where people for a long time have thought nothing happens in the Islamic world, it's all bad, it's all destruction, there's no creativity, nothing coming. From 1500 onwards we have major regional empires, early modern empires of the Ottomans, Sunni Muslims, the Safavids, Shi'i Muslims, and then the Mughals. They all start around the same time. So basically, the bottom of this decline paradigm is the coming of the Mongols. We all know they were bloodthirsty, etc., etc. They also established the largest contiguous world empire in history, which went all the way to Liegnitz in Poland, in the west, and all the way to Beijing and down into Korea, etc., in the east. To the southwestern corners of it is the Middle East, this area, and they left an impact that changed. We had trade circuits that participated in that, and we know that many of the movements of everything, be that the plague, which we can actually date, be that people, ideas, artifacts, languages move from actually east to west. The east was very, very important during this period. We see that reflected in the manuscripts, that people got interested in Buddhism in the Islamic world. So basically, decline is something that people are cleaning up with, and that's what my project is also doing. We have the expansion of Islam during this period, the number of Muslims in the world tripled. We have the Islamization of Anatolia, which was, of course, Christian before. We have the Mongols converting to Islam, and they become vectors into Russia, Central Asia, etc. We have the political devolution of the Abbasid Caliphate, so something like papacy being abolished happens during this time. It's a huge thing. We have military patronage states coming up like mushrooms, and all of the Islamic world under the Mamluks in the south of the Euphrates was led by military rulers, so a very big shift in terms of political authority. We have the incipient development of a secular law, first under the Mongols and then in the Ottoman Empire. So we have a parallel between Sharia and secular law, the Qanun. We have huge demographic changes. People move around a lot, just physically, but of course a lot of social mobility. Political unrest is often couched in religious terms, so we have lots of uprisings, and many of the intellectuals of that period are actually involved and are being persecuted. We have linguistic pluralism. It's not only Arabic, it's also Persian and then Turkish, that are vernaculars that become acceptable as written languages during this period. We have several centers of cultural patronage which are paralleled by this warlordism. We have the politicization of religion, both internally. We have confessionalization between different groups, and we also have then big empire connected confessionalization happening across boundaries. Concomitant with that, there is confession ambiguity, added loyalty, so some people can't really decide whether they are Sunni or Shi'i. All of that happens during this period. We have institutional Sufism, means mystical orders that actually are not just people, individuals who are sitting in a corner, but there are networks. These people are connected. The networks are hierarchically organized within the network. So you have somebody whom you follow. You have an initiation rite. You have specific centers where you enact your rites. You have institutions, etc. And we have also external challenges to Islam during this period, of course. Okay, the way that, as one example, Sufi orders are usually being described is that we have big areas which are blanked out with certain colors. So the Iranian Central Asian traditions are the blue guys, and then we have the North African one in orange, and then we have this kind of generally indicated, you know, Iraqi tradition based on Junaid. That's kind of how many things are being visualized, which I think we have a great chance by going through individuals to dot these areas rather than, you know, giving big, large areas, which is very, very, you know, very basic. Anyway, it's during this period that we see Sufi orders develop, the major ones here I've underlined, and they organize themselves as institutions. And these are, I mean, these names for you may be the little dark one in the dark corner, but the Kubrawiya, Chishtiya, Maulawiya, Safawiya, Bektashiya, etc., they are all Sufi orders that are as well established in the Islamic world as if you say, oh, this one is an Anabaptist, or this one is a Calvinist, or this one is, you know, a Huguenot or something. They're well established names in the Islamic world. Some of these, the red ones, turned Shi'i over the period of the 13th to the 15th centuries. They started out as Sunni, they Shi'itized, they changed their confession during this time. Very important. The modern day Iran that we know as a Shi'i state only became Shi'i around 1500, 1501 exactly. Before that, that was a majority Sunni country. So politics comes in on top of this. Some of these are really wacko. They think, and they're the intellectuals of the time, they actually think that we do not know the caste of the ulama who interpret the Quran. We each person themselves, can actually read the Holy Scripture, and the Holy Scripture is the book of nature. So everything in the world has a connection to the universe, represents this, is the word of God, can be read and deciphered by people. Huruf means letters, so these are letters, Kabbalists, essentially. And some of these are also millenarian. They believe that the end of the world is coming about, and they're also militant. Okay, social mobility is high. People may move from Samarkand to Cairo to Edirne and back. I don't know where they kind of, you know, Samarkand, Cairo, Edirne. This may be the one and the same person who is in these areas. If you look at the geography involved, these people traveled heavily, often for the Hajj, but forth and back. And what we have, I don't know whether you see these dots well or not. This is a visualization made by people here at the ERC, Oxford E-Research Center, where they put in the data that we had collected about activities, about people copying books into a database. Obviously, it's not yet finished. And what we can see, we have some of the expected suspects. We have you know, Cairo, we have Istanbul, we have Shiraz, we have Baghdad, Damascus, places like that, Bukhara, Tabriz. But we also see that there are all these little dots here in the mountains of Iran. And that's precisely where we can, this is where the map goes beyond the expected. This is where we can actually see that this is where all these incipient Shi'is were hanging out. Now, what impact is after are these manuscripts? Because for the 13th to 16th centuries and beyond, actually, 85% of these texts remain unpublished. They're simply not published. They're sitting as manuscripts in various libraries. However, the manuscripts themselves can give us a lot of information in their colophons. So the colophon is always marked, it gives us structured data, it sits in a nice triangular format, it will say precisely who wrote something, what the title is of the work. It says precisely it was copied at the beginning of the Dhulqa'dah of this particular year. And it will also give us a place, a location where it was copied. It would say it was copied in the madrasa of such and such a city. And it will also give us an owner stamp that predates often, you know, it's modern place. So with these structured data that come like that in every manuscript, you can actually capture the movement of people, of objects, the books, and people, and ideas. So this gives us a very, very precise indication of that. So what this ideal manuscript can tell us, we have tried to capture that in four different main categories in the same database that we share with cultures of knowledge. On the one hand, we have the books. So we have an abstract, Dante's Inferno, and all the physical copies, the manifestations, the actual copies. There was no print, so copies matter. People, they have roles, so they can be authors, copies, patrons, translators, versifiers, etc. And they also have affiliations, so they can have professional affiliations, of which there are many in Islam. There's a name for that, madhab. They can be mystical ones, the Sufi orders that we talked about. They can be geographical, they can't just be all geographical, they are geographical. So my name would be something like Xantani or so, coming from a town called Xanti. Somebody coming from Oxford would be Oxonian. On top of everything else, you always have what's called the nisba, your geographical location, the place where you come from is part of your name. So that's a very nice way, even if people were later moving, to say where they came from. So that kind of information is already in every name. Legal, we talked about that. People define themselves by their legal profession, so to say. By profession is a way of finding out more about people, and this is how we go beyond letters and beyond thinking our intellectuals. We have people who are butchers who copy Avicenna in our database. You wouldn't expect it. I mean, I see many Fon and Su in the, you know, in the names that we had in the. Not all of these people are there. They can read and write, and they think it's part of, you know, piety to copy a certain work. Although Avicenna was not part of the pious side. Philosophy is more on the other end still. Locations, places where books were written, copied, studied, etc., is important, and where people taught. So these are the nodes that we need to connect to, and I see here on our program very nicely that we will connect to time and to space, and obviously time, specific dates when books were written, copied, studied, and taught. So all of this information is sitting in this nice triangle. It gives us all this in a structured way. People were very, very careful about that. Interesting. And then of course we have the repositories. Where are these copies now, right? So that modern researchers can find those, but they also tell us something about the afterlife of these manuscripts. Okay, coming to the people, we thought through various ways of capturing that information that is already there in a structured way. So people have roles and they have affiliations. So their roles would be, they can be an author, a patron, teacher, versifier, abbreviator, and things like that. For the manifestation, the physical object itself, they could be the copyist or somebody who illuminated it, or somebody who taught it in a specific place, a student who put notes into the side, into the margins. So all of these we tried to capture, and that was one of the most laborious parts of the database, and one of the ones where we really came to the borders of cooperation with cultures of knowledge, because when we come to affiliation, these confessions are not the same, right? One could say, oh, we can translate confession into, well, I already mentioned a few, you know, you have Protestants, and then there would be subgroups of Calvinists and Lutherans, and one might put the Huguenots somewhere in there, and Anabaptists and people like that. But of course, they're different names. I don't think it would be too difficult, but it was something that I think was particularly labor intensive for the developers, where it took some time to make sure that we did get these represented, and so we now have the connection to the location. As I mentioned, every single name has a location in it. We have confessions. We have these legal schools where people decide on how they go about their testament, you know, about inheritance and about marriage and about punishment, etc. the theological schools, philosophical schools, Sufi organizations, which are really important. And then there's also these other, not so much vertically organized, of course spread, but still in terms of the hierarchies, not vertically organized, but more horizontally organized intellectual networks. These brethren of purity, Ikhwan Safa is how they call themselves, and they are occult and lettrist groups who write a lot about, for instance, unity, the unity of God, but what they actually also talk about is having one individual ruler. You know, the ruler is the shadow of God on earth. So it's anti-absolutist propaganda they are making, and so they are also being persecuted, and they are much more difficult to capture than these other things, but they are very important as well. And then we have all these professions. So these are things that were developed within impact. And I think a few of those were actually very much shared. So there we have shared universes, not parallel universes, with cultures of knowledge. And so this has been, I think, a very great step forward. And I'm thankful to the developers for actually picking this up and working on that. I think you put the address on here. This is how it looks. So basically we have the primary sources, people and associations, places. The repositories are obviously important, and then other action fields. Unfortunately, this isn't very, very clear. But for those who are familiar with cultures of knowledge, it's very similar. And we can then, for the NISPA, is this connection to the location. I think you have nationalities there,
yes,
or something.
Yes, yeah.
So basically, here one can actually create a particular location. Anyway, and didn't connect that location to the name, place name that's in the person's personal name, and then ticket. And this way, it's structured and standardized. So each of these also has a connection to a place. These are the professions and titles. So we have alchemists. We have people who are trained by profession, copyists, etc. So these are the different religious madhab affiliations, Hanafiya, Hanbaliya, Jafariya, etc. So this would be the correspondence to being Protestant and convert Protestant and Catholic and convert Catholic and these things that you have already in your database. That's just a continuation of that. Anyway. Thank you very much for listening to this, and I look forward to our discussion later. How to connect this actually to places and to dates.
Yes.
I think that is really crucial. But people do matter. They are very important. I think it's absolutely crucial that we go beyond letters or books and their copies, but rather focus on who these people are, because they are the ones who are actually. Who are writing the stuff, they're the ones who are connecting to other people, they're the things who are moving things, they're the ones that if we look at beyond letters, what's happening on the street, they are often la philosophie moderne, these are the people who are actually bringing things back. Now, if we think about connected rather than parallel universes, parallel in terms of shared problems, but connected in terms of really the people who are connected. And I very much agree with what you said earlier about, what's obscure for us may be very well known in another corner of the world. If one were at some point to achieve a connection, and with the digital world it's very easy, and we still have people who cannot be Googled, as you said, very true for these guys as well. That would be a true paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. Because it's obvious that Comenius talked to Kirchner. Or it's obvious that, my little group, they talked to each other. But that there were actually connections, that's something that we don't see normally. And those overlaps, Comenius going ahead and asking for these translations, or these books, be that medicine, be that the occult, be that alchemy and things like that, being through the objects, through the books, brought to Europe, and people actually going from Vienna to the port and trying to learn there, these connections did exist. But we cannot at this point really quantify them. We don't even think about them because of the linguistic difficulties and everything. But I think there is something to having, thinking about connections, I guess. Anyway, thank you.